Hello and welcome to Argue With Us at GameIndustry.com. I'm Shella.
And I'm Drew, and together we're arguing about the things that really matter in games and films and stuff.
Indeed we are, and it is Season 4, Episode 21.
Wow, indeed it is.
A lot of episodes and seasons. It is, when this airs, it's going to be Halloween.
Yeah, so this might actually end up being episode like 22. We might have to do these a bit out of order.
Oh yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Okay, but this is episode 21 production order. You know, a little behind the scenes look at how we do things here.
What's our topic for this episode, Drew?
Our topic is Gothic in games. It's a kind of special episode this week because we've got some guest casters, guest tossers, I guess we'd call them. Not to their faces. But, we've pre-recorded a sort of really interesting long discussion that we had. This is going to be quite a long episode, so you know it might take you a couple of commutes to get through this one. But it's all really interesting stuff, and I want to thank Emily and Lauren, Emily Marlowe and Lauren Nixon, who came on and just gave a fantastic sort of interview and discussion about what Gothic is, you know, how it applies to games. Talked about all the best Gothic games, which you are about to listen to now. It's a really fantastic talk. We had a lot of fun recording it. And one minor problem, there are some sound issues due to the sort of realities of recording podcasts between four people, all with different equipment. We've tried our best to kind of minimize them as much as possible, but you probably notice a little bit of fuzz on one end. But it's still audible, and we hope you enjoy it anyway.
Yeah, let us know. We're delighted to welcome Emily Marlowe and Lauren Nixon to Argue the Toss this episode for our Halloween special on the Gothic in games. So could you introduce yourselves, tell us what you do, and maybe what your connections are with Gothic or gaming or both? So Lauren, if we start with you.
Yeah, of course. I'm Lauren Nixon. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Sheffield. My thesis is called Conflicting Masculinities, and I study the figure of the soldier in the Gothic novel between 1764 and 1826, which might sound a little bit too old for the purposes of this, but I also run something called Sheffield Gothic, which is a group of postgrads who put on reading groups and conferences and events. And one of the things that we did this year was Gaming the Gothic, which was a bit of a passion project for me. But overall, I'm interested in the way in which the Gothic as a genre evolves and mutates, but continually represents anxieties about things like nationality and gender. So even though my focus is the long 18th century, I do a lot of contemporary stuff as well.
Excellent. I think that's how I met Emily, was through Gaming the Gothic. That kind of came into my feed and I was like, oh my god, how do I not know about this thing? So Emily, introduce yourself and what you do.
Okay, so my name is Emily Marlowe. I'm a PhD student at the University of Sheffield, where I study religion, masculinity and sexuality in film and television and in video games most prominently. So my research looks at representations of Jesus and Christ figures in media. So I look at people like, I look at Jesus films, but I also look at things like Captain America. And I look at the games that I look at are mainly BioWare games. So I look at Dragon Age Inquisition and Mass Effect. And I look at kind of how they deal with savior characters and also how those savior characters interact in regards to masculinity and sexuality. As far as Gothic stuff, I literally I met Lauren and a bunch of people who I've formed a group, a postgrad group called Sheffield Gothic, and I met them, and we basically had one of those conversations where they explained to me that everything that I liked ever since I was a teenager was actually Gothic, and that I should probably study Gothic stuff. But I do it mainly as like a passion project, because most of my research is in biblical studies and cultural studies. But yeah.
Yeah. I wish there'd been Sheffield Gothic when I was going to uni. It would have changed everything.
Yeah, we do come off a little bit cultish sometimes. We're I think we're all a little bit too happy and welcoming for academics. We're like, hey,
yeah, we did
you know about the Gothic?
Come join us.
One of us.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's like whenever we have like events on, I always love it when people come in who've never been to one of our events, because like we're quite inclusive and we're quite welcoming, but also like we do things like we decorate and we bake cakes and we like are just like the papers that are usually shown at Sheffield Gothic stuff are usually not what you would expect from like traditional academic discourse. So I just think it's really good. I love watching people react to coming to them.
It sounds cool. So we thought probably a useful thing would be to define Gothic. So most people probably think of women in 90s wandering through castles and graveyards, if you said, you know, what is Gothic to them. So seeing as Lauren seems to be the queen of darkness here tonight, what are the key elements of Gothic?
Well, that is a title to live up to. Okay, I'll do my best. I mean, that is Gothic. You'd be surprised, actually, how often we get asked to explain what the Gothic is, because it is a term that means many things, and I think that sometimes confuses people, because how can it mean so many things? The brief history of it is that you may or may not be familiar with a 3rd century nomadic Germanic people called the Goths. So there were a group of barbarians, as we would consider them, who originated from what we now know as Germany. There were the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths, and they were ultimately responsible for the fall of Rome. And Rome has always been considered, by culture, Western culture, as, you know, the height of human civilization and democracy. So the Goths being responsible for the fall of Rome made them barbaric and made them barbarous. So the term Gothic came to be used to mean barbaric and uncivilized and sort of like the antithesis of Rome. And it stayed that way for a couple of hundred years. And then during the Renaissance period, we have obviously again a European reclamation of art and culture. All of this stuff that we thought we'd lost, but we were just obviously not looking far enough. Gothic then became used to mean bad art. So in the Renaissance, they looked back at the medieval and they were like, ugh, those churches are really ugly. Like, they are bad. And because there seems to be bad art, they started to call them Gothic, meaning barbaric and barbarous and uncivilized. So pretty much everything medieval became Gothic. So if you think about medieval art and culture and architecture, you've got the supernatural, you've got superstitions, you've got death, you've got the macabre, you've got things like Memento Mori and an art form called Dance Macabre, which was very popular around the time of the plague, that was images of skeletons dancing into towns with music and almost like a fair, and then obviously carting everybody off to the grave. So all of the medieval art and architecture and literature became known as Gothic. So that's where the skulls, the supernatural, the devils, the demons, a lot of the stuff that we would still consider to be Gothic today, that's where that comes into it. So over the course of the 18th century, there's a sort of reclamation of the Gothic. The first Gothic novel was published in 1764, and it kicks off this trend that is still going today. Gothic is still, you know, it's still very much what it was in 1764, even though it's also so much more. So the Gothic has always been a language of terror and wonder, of, you know, questioning humanity, morality, mortality. It's been about using the supernatural to explore anxieties about the other, about the self. In more contemporary Gothic, you see the monster goes from being a point of terror to being a point of wonder. So if you think about the 90s Gothic, a lot of that supernatural romance, it's uses self-identification with the other. So rather than the other is the thing that we fear, the Gothic in contemporary culture has often become a way to explore non-normative identity. So the Gothic can be transgressive and subversive. It can also be conventional. So it is many things all at once, but all of those things that you would consider to be Gothic, you know, Dracula, Frankenstein is Gothic, but then The Cure is Gothic, and Adventure Time is Gothic.
They would deny that.
I know. But it's true.
because it's true, you're Gothic, true. Get over it, you sing about spiders.
They might not be Goth, but they're certainly Gothic. And there is that kind of Venn diagram. People are always really disappointed when they meet me because I don't look very Gothic.
Yeah.
But there is an overlap between Goth subculture and Gothic because, again, it's this identification with the other and an expression of self through discussions of death and mortality and the supernatural and a rejection of convention. So it's one of those forms, I think, because it is a language about anxiety and about things we are concerned about and things that we're not sure of. Every generation has its own Gothic. As much as I hate it to say it, something like 50 Shades of Grey is still part of that Gothic trend of, oh my gosh, there's this potentially subversive thing and I can explore a part of myself through it that maybe I was too afraid to talk about before.
But it's seen as kind of dark, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's also Gothic novels in the 1800s were seen as dangerous and trashy. So anyone that's read Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey probably already knows this, but the Gothic, it was like, oh, don't let your daughters read Gothic because they'll get funny ideas about things.
But wandering through men's castles.
Exactly, but then what was happening was you had female writers who were like, oh, okay, the male critic thinks that this is trashy. So I'll let them think it's trashy, but what I will do is write a story that will allow a young woman who otherwise knows nothing of the world to experience passion and terror and wonder. So it's always been a sort of language, a language of subversion and the other, and a way to communicate with each other, sort of under the nose of society and of patriarchal society in particular. If that makes sense.
And it has had that thing, like you said, of women being able to explore their sexuality and sort of move through the world and find passions and things that they weren't allowed to do when those stories were being written. Well, and still now.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so I think we've got it. So if people think it's bats, castles, graveyards, sort of women in 90s, it is that and more as well. I'm quite interested in American Gothic and particularly Southern Gothic because it moves the Gothic away from the European tradition, which is, you know, very pale-skinned women, you know, everybody's white pretty much. Whereas once it moves over to America, of course, with slavery and the fact that black people are there, it kind of shifts a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about American Gothic and particularly Southern Gothic?
Yeah, of
course. People might not be aware of what the difference is.
Yeah, so Southern Gothic and American Gothic. American Gothic and New England Gothic kind of comes first. And it's coming out of a tradition that something like Dracula is a part of. So Dracula is one in a long line of Gothic texts that is very concerned about the other, about the foreign other. So Dracula himself is, you know, he's racially ambiguous, he's culturally ambiguous. He's ancient, there's something subversive and potentially devious about him. So a lot of sort of Victorian Gothic is very concerned with race and with civilization and with nationality and the kind of blending of borders and the confusion between national borders. So American Gothic and early American Gothic in particular is very concerned with this idea of legacy. And you get this in Edgar Allan Poe, and you get this I hate to mention it, but H.P. Lovecraft in quite a negative way. But you can see this anxiety there. So then you do start to get stuff like, there's a lot of Creole Gothic. So you get stuff like Florence Marryat's Blood of the Vampire, which comes out just before Dracula. And there is the main character of that is a female psychic vampire who is of ambiguous origins, and this is one of the things that the society she moves in are worried about. You know, they don't know what her family is, they don't know what her parentage is. So in the kind of early American tradition, there is this prevailing concern about the fact that this is a new nation, so how do you know who anybody is? And then, is that important? So American Gothic, in its early stages, is very concerned with degeneration. You have a lot of stories of families who have left behind a terrible past in England, where they've been murderers or they've done something awful and that kind of followed them. You have, obviously, the haunted house narrative, which is something that's always been present in the Gothic, but really starts to come alive in the American Gothic. So New England is where kind of a lot of the early Gothic comes out from, with people like Edgar Allan Poe. And then as time goes by, you start to get Southern Gothic, which is usually centered around places like New Orleans and Louisiana. And again, it's about this, this idea of melting pots of societies and multiple different cultures and nationalities coming together and the anxiety coming out of that. And I know I keep using that word anxiety, but people were very worried about things like this. Yeah. So a lot of the stories that you'll get in the early American Gothic are about vampires, because there is a concern about the longevity of the vampire and the uncertainty of where the vampire comes from and the way that the vampires feed off others. But Southern Gothic in particular is one of the traditions that I was kind of mentioning a moment ago, where as it's gone on, it's become a genre where members of minority communities can use the Gothic as a framework to explore their own identity, their identity as other, their identity as American. They can use it to reclaim a part of their identity, their sexuality, their heritage. And over time, the Southern Gothic has become a place where you can have these conversations that seem to be taboo or subversive or transgressive in a really positive way. So the Southern Gothic is really interesting. And if you're interested in American and Southern Gothic, I highly recommend Maisha West's work. She was a visiting scholar here with us at Sheffield last year, a Fulbright scholar. And she's currently at the University of Indiana. And she does some really interesting work on Black American Gothic and diaspora. She would talk...
What's her name, sorry?
Maisha Wester. Okay. She's absolutely fantastic. Highly recommend. I've seen her give some really fascinating talks on diaspora great. Gothic. She does a lot on African American monstrosity and monsters. She's a really fantastic scholar. If you are interested in American Gothic and in Southern Gothic and in Black Gothic, I highly recommend her work. She's doing some really interesting stuff.
That sounds amazing. That sounds that's cool. Yeah, I've got stuff to read. Yeah, because I've tried Googling it to find the Black in Gothic, I found it really difficult. And then of course we've had things like Beyoncé has been playing with those images in her Lemonade video, which was really cool. So she was playing around with that sense of sort of Southern decay, and I found Southern Gothic is quite grounded, isn't it?
The Gothic often does this thing where they have the supernatural, but the supernatural isn't the thing that you actually need to be worried of. The thing you need to be worried about is people and what people are capable of and the things that people can do to other people. So a lot of Southern Gothic uses the ghost story or the monster as a warning or remembrance of the past, but not as the thing that is actually you know, the monster isn't the real monster. The real monster is the things that people can do to one another. And a really good example of that is Toni Morrison's Beloved, which is an excellent example of a Black Southern Gothic text. And the conventions that Morrison uses in the way in which she tells that story, you have this supernatural element. There's this idea of, you know, vampirism, but the real horror is coming from real people, not from the supernatural. The supernatural is almost a byproduct of the transgression, if that makes sense. And that's something you see again and again in these texts. And I know from hearing her give a couple of lectures that that's something that Maisha is really interested in and talks about very eloquently.
Cool. So are there any other examples of non-European cultures taking the Gothic and making it their own? I was wondering if Latin American magical realism kind of crosses into the Gothic. And then, of course, we've got sort of East Asia, Japan and Korea. They dive into that.
But... Yeah, definitely. So last year, the International Gothic Association, which is an academic organisation for academics and postgraduates working in the Gothic, was held at the Universidad de las Américas Puebla, which is in central Mexico. And a lot of that conference was devoted to exploring Latin American Gothic and the way in which Latin American history feeds into the Gothic. So again, this idea of legacy and heritage and identity. We also had, so the academic who ran the EIGA last year, Enrique Ajuria Ibarra, he's at the University of Puebla, and he does some really fantastic work on Latin American cinema, particularly Mexican cinema and Gothic cinema. So definitely, definitely in Mexican cinema, there's a massive tradition of the Gothic, and there's a lot of blending of magical realism and the Gothic. Definitely, magical realism goes hand in hand. There's some really fantastic books and films. There's a big tradition there, and again, it's that kind of drawing on Aztec and Mayan legacy, and then you know the ongoing scars from the conquistadors, and what it means to be Mexican in like a contemporary society, and how do you connect with your past? There's a massive tradition there, really fascinating. There was a collection of short stories, and I can't remember the name of the author, but the English title is The Things We Lost in the Fire. Which is a fantastic collection of Latin American Gothic short stories that I highly recommend. Certainly in Latin American tradition. Obviously things like Del Toro's movies, Pan's Labyrinth, is a really great example. The Shape of Water, but then you've got a really interesting, actually, I feel terrible because I can't remember the director's name, but whilst we were at the conference, we watched a short film which was about vampire nuns it's in Cholula, which is a small town where the university is. There is a convent that's built on top of what was once the temple of the Quetzalcoatl. And the story is that the conquistadors gathered all the people in the temple and then slaughtered them and then built this convent on top of it. So there's a lot of kind of those narratives of things being on top of other narratives. And you get that in the American Gothic as well, you know.
Yeah.
There's something underneath that's bleeding through that is refusing to be forgotten.
It's the Southern Gothic, it's with slavery, guilt and the blood in the land kind of thing really feeds into that.
100%. And again, a lot of the supernatural elements are often kind of memories of pain and trauma. So you have a really strong narrative there. In terms of Southeast Asian Gothic, There's been a lot over the last few years, a couple of really great texts. I think there's been a handbook as well about Southeast Asian Gothic, which again is drawing on tradition. So if you think of a lot of Japanese movies, so things like The Ring, there's often, you know, it's drawing on an older legend. So you have things like contemporary horror films about yokai or about spirits and about demons. So there is, again, in the East Asian tradition, that blending of contemporary and ancient and what it means to be like a modern member of society. There's, you often find in the Gothic, it's very concerned with the past and how the past affects the present. But yeah, I mean, it's not, it's an area that I'm hoping, obviously the PhD, you have to be super specific while you're doing it. But I do find myself getting distracted, particularly by Latin American and Southeast Asian Gothic. Emily and I have talked in depth about things like Hachimura's The Handmaiden, which is based on a Sarah Waters novel called Fingersmith, which is also extremely Gothic. So it's definitely, if there's anyone out there that's thinking of studying the Gothic at postgraduate level, those would be two areas to go into, because people are becoming increasingly interested in them. And obviously, in terms of popularity with world cinema, it's slowly becoming more and more at the focus. So if there's any aspiring Gothic scholars out there, I highly recommend thinking about going into a more global Gothic.
Cool.
Well, you're getting really great, like, deep answers here. I'm just sorry, I'm not contributing much. I'm just sitting here, kind of at rapt attention. Okay, so what was it you said your PhD was on?
And my PhD is on the figure of the soldier in 18th century Gothic. So I look at mostly the revolutionary Napoleonic Wars and the way in which masculinity and national identity are interconnected. There was, as there always is, a crisis of masculinity in Britain in the long 18th century. So my thesis looks at the way in which that crisis and that anxiety was being represented, particularly in the Gothic fiction. Because the Gothic in the 18th century is usually always analogy. It uses the past to explore the present in a way that is safe, quote-unquote, in that you're not going to get arrested for treason. So my main focus for my research is masculinity and national identity.
Okay, so, I mean, can you tell us a bit more about that? What's, like, the classic Gothic male character?
So you have, I mean, if we're talking archetypes, because Gothic does tend to deal more in archetypes rather than stereotypes. We're talking archetypes, the two central archetypes in the Gothic are the Gothic villain and the Gothic hero. The Gothic villain is often also the anti-hero. So in the first Gothic novel, The Castle of Otranto, the villain was this feudal father figure, so this ancient, and when they say ancient, they usually mean 12th century, not really ancient. So the villain in that novel is a man called Manfred, and he is the lord of this castle that his ancestors have come to inherit by devious means. He's not the true heir to the castle. And there's a sort of prophecy that says if his line ever ends, then the castle will fall. He's desperate to make sure that his lineage continues. At the start of the novel, his very sickly son is crushed to death by a giant spectral helmet.
That
falls from the sky.
I hate it when that happens.
I know. And rather than he has a daughter who's very beautiful and perfectly of marriable age, but his solution to the problem of making sure his lineage continues is that he decides that he will marry the girl who has been living in his home for the last few years, who is intended to be his daughter-in-law. He decides he'll marry her himself. What then proceeds to happen is he casts off his wife, his daughter's horrified, and the two girls essentially run round the castle through all of the sort of secret passages and basements and dungeons, trying to escape him. the true heir to the castle appears, but they think he's a peasant. But he is this very dark, sublime, and powerful figure. So it's very feudal. And as the Gothic novel goes on, what you get usually in this archetype is this kind of dark, domineering, powerful, almost brutish, but not quite. It's very much that kind of classic. There's something alluring about him, but he is morally grey quite often. So you often have in these novels this kind of sublime, almost awesome in terms of the word awestruck, masculine figure who represents a sort of patriarchal feudal power, and is usually pitted against the Gothic hero, who is very much a recreation of the chivalric Arthurian hero. So he does the right thing because it's the right thing to do, and he's brave and he's valiant, but he's also sensitive and possesses a great sensibility. So he's moved by the heroine's tears, and whilst he's often in love with her, the reason that he protects her is because she's a damsel in distress, and that's the right thing to do. So you have these two kind of archetypal figures right through the 18th century. Starts to become more complicated in the 19th century Gothic when you get things like Dracula. But you can still see traces of those archetypes, even today.
I'm watching Vampire Diaries at the moment.
I was just about
it's
to
got
say,
the twin brothers yes, who are basically that.
Exactly. Exactly. The two boys in Vampire Diaries are a modern version of the villain and hero archetype, definitely.
Yeah.
The Gothic predates Byron, but Byron's popularity does complicate those archetypes a little bit. And quite often in the 19th century Gothic, you don't have the hero. The hero doesn't exist. You only have the Gothic villain. And he becomes much more of an anti-hero. A really interesting example of the way they play with these conventions would be Del Toro's Crimson Peak, which is very heavily inspired it was kind of missold as a horror movie. What it is very much an homage to the 18th century Gothic. You can see Anne Radcliffe in it very, very heavily. And obviously you have Tom Hiddleston's character, who is that kind of, you're unsure who he really is and what his motives are, and then you have Charlie Hunnam, literally blonde, handsome, American, wholesome.
Boring.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing about the Gothic, and over time, the Gothic hero has become he's kind of been left by the wayside because he's not interesting in the way that the Gothic villain or the anti-hero is. And one of the things that I'm interested in when I talk about more contemporary texts is the way that Gothic aesthetics is used when we're portraying masculinity specifically to engage the female gaze and to arouse the female gaze rather than to kind of create. I mean, it's still that terror. And when I say terror, I mean the experience of going on a roller coaster, something that is scary but opens your mind. So terror is very much that experience of, you know, I'm afraid, and for a moment I fear for my life, but the experience has been an adrenaline rush and my mind is open afterwards, whereas horror is a stunting experience that prevents you from continuing onwards. Terror is that kind of wonder and that awe. And that's something that you get, particularly in the 19th and the 20th century, with the Gothic man, is that he is a figure of terror and wonder and awe, and that kind of shouldn't be attractive but is archetype.
That's Damon in the Vampire Diaries.
Yeah.
My feminist brain is coming up, but I'm going, yes.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, that's the really interesting thing about the Gothic is you can talk. I gave a paper at this year's IGA that was about trauma in the Gothic soldier, and I started out by talking about a book that was released in 1789, and I finished by talking about Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and Dragon Age, because even though they're 200 years apart, the same conventions and the same themes are being used, so you can read them side by side. And I think that's one of the really amazing things about the Gothic, is if you want to do a text that was published, I mean, one of our students did Faustus, which is, you know, Christopher Marlowe, we're talking 16th century. alongside films that were published, that released in 2015. So it is a platform where you can speak about a whole host of things, and it's not grasping at straws. You can see these very clear lines between them.
Yeah. Wow. Again, another really super detailed, awesome answer.
I feel like I'm talking too much.
No.
Not at all, no. So just to go on to the flip side of that, so we've talked about the male archetypes. Now, what are the female equivalents? We already mentioned kind of women in 90s running across graveyards, but like, what are the other archetypes? And have they changed? Like, how have they changed across the sort of... Or have they stayed exactly the same as in the case of like Faustus? And...
So the female archetype is interesting, because when you first read the 18th century Gothic, the female characters seem useless. They seem sort of wet, and they seem, you know, like they don't do anything to themselves and they don't protect themselves. But actually, when you compare the Gothic to perhaps the novel of sensibility, which is a trend that is about, you know, 2 years before, the Gothic heroine, she's brave, she's smart. She is aware of the fact that it's dangerous for her to be a woman out in the world by herself, but she's very stoic, she's very capable. She does faint and swoon, but actually the things that she is exposed to, you know, the terrors that she's forced to experience, she manages to withstand them. So whilst it's easy to see that figure of, you know, the woman in the white 90 walking down the hallway holding a candlestick, and kind of scoff. And when I first started my PhD studies, my original PhD proposal was about the fact that the heroines are rubbish, basically. And then as I started reading them in more depth, I realised actually they're not. They're these very brave, very complex. Yeah. And it's the first time...
I was going to say they're braver than me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that too sometimes. I'd definitely just be like, nope.
Like, exactly, I'd just be like head under the covers.
Yeah, I mean, particularly, you know, so I do a lot of Anne Radcliffe, who is the most popular Gothic author, and in fact one of the most popular authors of the 1780s and 90s. Her heroines refuse to believe in the supernatural, so they're very rational, and they're very logical, and they're very sensible.
That's
but they're also, you know, so the servant is saying, oh, Emily, there's definitely a ghost down that corridor, and Emily is like, no, there's not, and I will prove to you there's not. So I'm going to walk down there with my candlestick, and I'm going to prove to you that there's nothing supernatural in this corridor. So actually they are very complex, and in terms of the 18th century, it's the first time really that women are allowed to be complex, and that female characters have their inner workings explored, so the way that they feel and why they feel it and how they think. So the Gothic heroine can seem reductive, and sometimes she is. There's plenty of examples of Gothic text where the girl is just really wet and limp, but they're usually male authored. So the Gothic heroine is usually someone who possesses what we called in the 18th century a fine sensibility. So basically, very perceptive, very empathetic, very aware. But she's usually brave, and she's stoic, and, you know, she is either forced to be independent or she chooses to be independent. So I think, I mean, I watch something like Stranger Things, and I see a character like Nancy, and I can see Nancy in the heroines of the 18th century Gothic. So I think the heroine is a little bit more complicated, because a lot of the popular contemporary texts that we would think of as Gothic are often male authored, and the female characters are often either bystanders or they are plot devices to allow the horror or the terror to happen. Whereas in female authored Gothic, I mean, like, say things like Vampire Diaries, even God forbid, things like Twilight, it's the Gothic heroine, even when she's a self-insert, the reason she's a self-insert is because it's the writer inviting the reader to explore a portion of themselves in a safe space. So yeah, I mean, the Gothic heroine, I feel like she is often a really misunderstood figure, because I certainly thought she was really limp and pathetic when I first started reading them. And as I've studied them in more depth, I've realised she's a bit of a force of nature, really. She's a character to be reckoned with. And I think if I was trapped in an ancient castle that may or may not be haunted, I would definitely want one of them on my team. So yeah, I always get quite defensive of the gothic heroine because I know that I massively misunderstood her.
And to say that a woman is rational, at that time is quite a statement.
Yeah, huge statement. And usually, you know, often, even if there is a hero, the heroine is often the one saying, come on, let's be serious. Like, let's be sensible. So, yeah, you can still, I think, in particularly, Nancy from Stranger Things is a really interesting character, but particularly in those young female kind of late teenage, we're all quite excited about the upcoming Sabrina adaptation. There's definitely a lineage there in terms of the gothic female, and what she represents.
Okay, so we're nearly going to get on to games. We've still got Emily with us.
There we are.
That's fine. That's why I said you should get her on. She's too good for her own good.
Yeah, she knows her shit.
Yes, she does.
So just before we get on to games, I was just wondering, where do you draw the line between horror and gothic, and is there one?
Yes and no. So not all horror is gothic.
Yeah.
And vice versa, but there is a massive overlap.
Mm-hmm.
Gothic, obviously, in that if you're thinking of gothic as being supernatural, as being about people's anxieties, you know, the zombie, for example, becomes popular during a period of time where people are worried about infection and worried about mass consumerism. So usually you can track trends in horror movies alongside political and cultural events. So in terms of analogy, there is a lot of overlap between the gothic and horror. But when the gothic was first conceived, so I know I spoke about this earlier, but this idea of terror and the sublime. So the gothic is a lot more interested. There is horror gothic and terror gothic. The gothic that I study is more
terror.
Could
you define the sublime that people might not know?
The sublime is, to put it really simply, the sublime is that feeling when you go out somewhere or you go to a landmark or you go to a natural landmark and you have that feeling, that overwhelming, awesome feeling where you can't quite behold the beauty or the intricacy of nature. So the sublime is that kind of, that experience of witnessing something that is almost beyond human comprehension. And in the 18th century, it's often defined as man's inability to fully understand God's creation. In more contemporary secular society, it's that kind of, that cosmic awesomeness or, you know, nature's
isn't nature
awesomeness.
Brilliant?
Basically. It's like that feeling where you kind of see something and for a moment you're dumbstruck by it and you can't quite believe what you've seen. So the sublime is that, it is almost overwhelming. It's that kind of you're kind of, and that's the terror experience. And the way that I always describe terror is, it's the haunted house or the roller coaster. You know that you are going to get out the other side, but whilst you're experiencing it, you have that rush of blood, you have that fear. But then when you've come through it, you almost feel like it's almost like ascending to a higher plane. You have that moment of like, oh my God, you know, it's that experience that broadens the mind and opens you up and like you can connect to people. And, you know, you'll often, when people talk about things like near-death experiences, it's that kind of way that they talk about that. So terror is that almost pleasing feeling. Like, it's terrifying, it's scary, but you almost crave it. It's that kind of, like, you feel alive afterwards. Horror was always kind of defined as something that stunts and stops. So the experience of horror is more like the trauma experience. It prevents you from growing. It prevents you from continuing. Horror is something that is so horrible, you are unable to continue on after it. So when we talk about horror as a film genre, and again, I'm not a horror critic, and I would hate step anyone's toes. There's a really, really great book on horror by a scholar at Manchester Metropolitan University, Xavier Adorno-Reyes, who I believe is for the British Library, a fantastic book. But often things that we think of as horror cinema are not necessarily horror in terms of what the word actually means. So the genre itself and the meaning of the term that when we use it academically don't always marry up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things where there's not, I don't know if I've made that sound very clear, and it's not very clear. There is an overlap, but then at times there isn't. And I would say probably something like, the difference would be something like Saw and something like The Shining. Mm-hmm. They, you know, they exist kind of in the same genre, but separately, and academic study would approach them differently.
Interesting. So, games. The difference between sort of horror and terror and the sublime that you described, with one opening and one stopping, I definitely would apply that to horror games. Yeah. Horror games just stop me.
Yes.
I don't want to work. If the door opens, I'm like, oh crap, why did it have to open? If the door remains locked, I'm like, phew, let me just see another door.
Yeah, no, so, good at horror games.
Yeah, no, me either. I can't do it. But, so, Emily, hello.
Hi.
So, would you say that there is much of a gothic tradition within video games?
Oh, I think there's massive gothic tradition in video games. I think if you look, I mean, when we were talking about, like, favourite gothic games and how we were going to do this podcast, it's actually one of those things that one of my favorite gothic games is one of the earlier, or one of what I consider the earlier video games, which is showing my age, which is Day of the Tentacle by Sierra. Yeah. Because
It's by LucasArts, but
yeah, by LucasArts. Sorry, I always get the two confused. Now I'm going to get all this feedback. No, but
you've done it now.
Yeah, exactly. Clearly, I've never played the game before. So Day of the Tentacle for me was always, I think that's a great example of a gothic game, because it is essentially the haunted house, but it's also time travel. It's also identities changing and people betraying each other and all this kind of mystery and all that kind of stuff, and sentient beings that are used to be tentacles and all these kind of things. And it's also got the humour. I think a lot of the early gothic games, things like Rogue, things like Day of the Tentacle, even things like Myst, had real touches of gothic tropes and or archetypes, and it's just continued on. It just changes. I think they changed the genre, really, because, like, a lot of people, when we've talked to them about gothic games, they'll sort of say, oh, you mean Dark Souls, or oh, you mean Devil May Cry, or something that is, you know, overtly
gothic.
Aesthetically gothic. And a lot of people will sort of go, oh, that's gothic. Whereas, or they'll say, like, survival games like Bioshock, you know, classically gothic. And they are, but at the same time, I think people forget games like Everybody's Gone to the Rapture is amazingly gothic, because it's it's the Children of the Corn. It's the town where everything's gone wrong. It's very Stephen King. It's very New England, because it's this place where something, everyone's gone for some reason, and you've got to work out why. But also, you don't you don't really want to work out why, because it's this kind of horrible secret. So yeah, I think it's been there since the start, and it changes with genres, but there's always touches of it through across genre.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wouldn't have thought about Everybody's Gone to the Rapture as a gothic game, but now that you've sort of described it in those terms, yeah, I can absolutely see that. And again, it's touching on the sort of like the sublime in that it's this much. I don't want to spoil it for anyone who's listening and hasn't played the game before, but what that turned out to be.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. We already did an episode on this. So
I think it's been free on PlayStation at some point, so.
Yes, it has. and that's the market. But the solution to that game is that it is this much higher, sort of impenetrable, impossibly big kind of cosmic power that's sort of interfering with something smaller. So that's
exactly, and it also does a touch of I'm going to try here, Lauren. It does a touch of Radcliffe, because it has that idea of, I think, 3/4 of the way through the game, it's that idea of, oh, maybe it was just this guy, or maybe it's all a scientific thing that can be explained, and you have a lot of those false mysteries, and that's very, you know, like it being just people and not something cosmic is very gothic, so it does really flirt with the genre, I think.
That's interesting.
So I mean if you wanted see, we've sort of answered my next question here.
Sorry.
I was going to say, I was wondering whether games tended towards a certain type or certain aspects of gothic, because, yeah, the stuff we've got written down as examples of goth games, gothic games, I should say, are like Castlevania and Devil May Cry, and to an extent things like Resident Evil, Dark Souls, definitely.
Well, definitely, it's also like, they don't just do the gothic aesthetics, though. I think you can also get gothic narratives in them. There's also lots of things that, like there's a whole subgenre of things called happy gothic, which is using all of those basic tropes, but then basically flipping the feeling. And it's this like things like Bayonetta, you know, a lot of the kind of cute. Like we had a talk at our conference this last year about the Pokemon Town. Is it Lavender Town?
Lavender Town is epic. Super creepy.
So it's all different ways.
I mean, the gothic also, the gothic is camp. The gothic has always had this camp element to it, and you know, people tend to think of gothic as being something that is inherently dark, but there is this kind of, you know, there's always humour in the macabre. So there is an element, like Emily said, of the happy gothic, but there is also, gothic is often what we call like multi or metatextual. So like the first gothic novel wasn't presented as a novel, that it was presented as a found manuscript. And in contemporary Gothic, you have, you know, texts pretending to be other things or texts with interactions. So one of the things that I think Emily and I have discussed a lot about gaming and the Gothic is that the experience of play. And I talked about this at the IGA this year, that, for example, in the Dragon Age games, you haven't, over the course of those three narratives, the choices that you make impact the characters. And you, the player, through your experience of play, experience things like trauma or the supernatural. So even the fact that games can be played multiple times, or that there's multiple endings, or that they interact with one another, that kind of the player relationship with the game has gothic elements in of itself. And that's something that I think a lot of gothic scholarship is moving towards now, the fact that it's not a case of the narrative or the play, but the way in which those two things link together to create an experience that can be read through the Gothic.
The multi-textual aspect of it, I mean, that's such a massive thing in gaming today now anyway, in the sense of how it's, you know, we don't have finished games anymore. we have games that never end, and we have all these different ways that the narrative within that game is exposition to the player. You know, even things like when you're playing Witcher and you collect books, there, you know, you're collecting books that are actually about Geralt of Rivia, so it's kind of this metatextual narrative that's happening, as well as the metatextual that's happening with play itself.
Yeah, it's really interesting because now I'm thinking about different games and aspects of them are gothic. So things like Her Story
by
Sam Barlow. Yeah, with the sort of the sisters.
Yeah,
it's very, what's her name, Virginia Andrews style kind of family melodrama type thing.
Yeah, and Gone Home and Life is Strange.
Life is Strange is a really good example.
Yeah, well, like...
Oh, okay, so can we talk about Life is Strange a little bit?
And... Yeah.
I haven't, I would confess, I haven't finished it, but I think Emily has.
I haven't.
Have you not? Oh, no.
No, that's that.
So, well, as far as you've got from what you've seen, you talk a bit about...
Yeah, just, I mean, partially the fact that you are focusing on two young women, and the relationship between young women, again, I mentioned this earlier, but the fact that the Gothic is a space where the minute details that almost seem inconsequential, boring of female relationships can be explored. The episodic structure, you know, the way it was released. Oh gosh, it's been a while since I played it. Just the pacing. I mean, another really good example is something like Night of the Woods.
I was wondering about that because recording.
So, you know, I think there's been a trend recently of those games, of the resurgent those games when nothing much happens, but the experience of, and I mean, we were, again, Emily mentioned the Lavender Town thing. We have had quite a lot of examples in games recently where things haven't been explained. So the fact that in Lavender Town, you're never, like, you run around the town and you're thinking, well, there must be an explanation for why there's this creepy radio signal and why there's these ghosts, and the game doesn't give you an explanation.
Yeah.
So you as the player are left with that kind of unknown experience. You know, you don't get to solve the mystery and you don't find out what's really happened. And I think some of the Telltale games as well, just the way that you, the player, are forced to be a part of, but also a spectator of the story. It's a classic Gothic trope of it being used in such a new and different way. It's really exciting, actually, to see the way that video game narrative is using things like American Gothic, you know, dilapidated towns, and, I mean, Night in the Woods is a fantastic example, and Ewan Kirkman did a really great keynote for us that mostly focused on that game. I think you say Gothic games and people are like, oh yeah, Bloodborne.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, but also, and I mean, we had this, you know, we had papers on D&D, and the obvious example was The Curse of Strahd. But even, you know, the normal, like, something like Prince of the Apocalypse is a really great example of, you know, a text that could be read as Gothic. So it's a really exciting field to be a part of at the moment.
That's interesting. So something like The Last of Us would...
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Especially because that deals again with the differences between men and women, between adults and children. Mm-hmm. It's a coming of age text, which definitely fills into it. It's the young heroine text. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of the man who is essentially scary, but still like well intentioned, and he wants to protect her, and he wants to be the knight in shining armor, but he's got to do horrible things.
Yeah.
It's got it all over it.
That's excellent. So Joel is classic Gothic hero or man.
Although to be fair, I mean, Joel is also every protagonist of every blockbuster
video game
recently. So, we often play this game at work where we say, "But is it Gothic?" And the answer is always yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even what The Last of Us did with the idea of the zombie.
So I'm
terrified of zombies, and I once thought, well, if I find out why zombies are scary and what they represent, then maybe I'll find them less terrifying. And it made me more afraid of
them. Especially the biological aspect of the zombies in Last of Us, like the way it's like festering affliction.
There's a lot of social anxiety there.
A lot. We need more alcohol hand jams. So we've kind of touched a bit on sort of male-female characters in Gothic games, but are there any shifts in the representation of men and women in video games that, you know, have Gothic elements as opposed to other media? Or do they just follow the same?
Well, I mean, one of the things...
Or would they not be Gothic? They're just the not Gothic ones.
I think there's... I mean, this is one of my main arguments in my PhD, but I think there's a massive shift in how we portray masculine characters in games especially. And I think that's happening because of, obviously, like, wider social issues. Definitely you're getting a lot of feedback from... feminism, from any kind of progression in women's rights, you obviously always see a kind of knock-on effect. But the interesting thing is that we're actually seeing quite a softening of masculine characters. And like Lauren was saying, I think a lot of it is coming because of this kind of commodification of the female gaze. And it's this idea that now our male heroes can't no longer be that kind of stoic, closed off, super macho kind of character, because that's not what everyone wants anymore. And because of that shift in kind of consumers, you're getting now these really nuanced a term that we've been using recently is soft masculine characters.
Yeah.
So it's this idea of a character who can be strong and protective and honourable, but also fierce and, you know, gentle, hard but soft. You know, it's this kind of duality that's happening in a lot of characters. So a good example in a Gothic game would be Geralt of Rivia, in the sense that like when I started playing Witcher 3, I was very much like, I knew the history of the Witcher games, and I was very concerned about how women had been treated, how black people had been treated, how history had been treated, and was really worried about this character. And I remember when I first started playing, for the first month or so, I really didn't like him because he seemed really gruff. And then when I started really, like, choosing actively what he was doing, and obviously he's a character that you can choose what he does and what he says, but not all the time. So this allowed for, because I always play as a good guy, he was always being nice to people and he was helping people. But of course, because he's Geralt of Rivia, he still retains a bit of his own, you know, ability to control what's going on. So he would occasionally throw out these kind of gruff lines. So it'd be like, he'd be helping someone and be like, oh no, that's totally fine, I can do that. And then he'd be like, not like I care anyway. So you'd get this kind of wonderful thing that he was this gruff, serious character, but then he could flirt with people and then he could be nice to people and he could be whimsical. And I think because games are doing this thing where they want everyone to be able to represent them, well, not all of them are, but they want representation, they want people to self-identify, they want greater immersion, and the way to get that is
to get...
Beg your pardon?
So there are sort of facets.
They want things to be more diverse, and because of that, our characters are becoming characters like Cullen from Dragon Age, who is this, when you look at him on paper, he's this archetypal Gothic hero, but because he's being created in a text that is thoroughly modern, he's also dealing with trauma, and he's also sharing that with his partner and being really open with her. And you get this duality that you never used to get with video game characters.
Mm. Paul is a really interesting example. He is an extension of some of the characters that I'm looking at in the 18th century Gothic, Cullen, in Dragon Age, because a lot of the soldier hero characters in the early Gothic were written by female authors, and they are written to be an ideal, a female ideal of masculinity. This is what we want. This is what we want. We want a man who is brave, but is also healing and can draw his sword, but also values me and respects me and understands me, which is quite a revolutionary thing to be saying in 1792. Mm-hmm. And Cullen is almost a contemporary extension of that. Initially he seems awful, and depending on what you do in Origins, he can do awful things. But then when you get to Inquisition, they like tear him apart and they lay him out on the table. And as this kind of broken, traumatized character, the way that the game explores his psyche and how that affects the Inquisitor she romances him is, I think, really interesting use of an older Gothic convention in a very modern text. Not just biased, it's not just because I romanced him. I started playing it and I thought, oh, this is really interesting because I'm seeing the same things in this that I'm seeing in this 18th century novel. So I think it's a really interesting way in which games and the player's choice in gaming is being channeled through those kind of like Gothic frameworks. Mm.
Yeah. Okay, sorry.
Drew's waking up from a rev.
I was just thinking about all the stuff I did in Dragon Age. I didn't bother with Cullen because I knew him vaguely from the first game, so I just ignored him entirely. Okay, so this is going to be, I think this is going to be a really difficult question, but if you had to narrow it down to, let's say, three games that sort of do Gothic really well, or like demonstrate some like essential facet of Gothic, what would you choose?
Oh, okay. I have been thinking about this.
Top three questions are awful.
So I think one of my choices would be Child of Light.
Okay.
Which in its,
love that game.
Yeah, and the way that the fairy tale, the aesthetic itself is quite Gothic. The fairy tale, the young female heroine. Mm-hmm. The kind of nostalgia that it captures. I think Monument Valley does a slightly similar thing, but it's less narrative focused. But I think Child of Light, the Gothic and the fairy story and folklore have always been kind of, have a lot of overlaps. I think Child of Light is a really interesting example of a Gothic narrative in a very traditional sense, in terms of a supernatural story of good versus evil, but that is also very interested in an inner, like the inner person. You know, it's not just a broad stroke story. It's about choices, and it's about relationships, and it's about the small acts towards, you know, other creatures and other human beings. And I think,
the way she interacts with the world, and the sort of characters that she's given.
I know the game's quite old, I don't want to spoil it because it's such a fantastic game, but yeah, I think Child of Light would definitely be one of my main recommendations. I think Final Fantasy XV, for all its flaws, the way in which that game started out as quite a light-hearted road trip with your bros. and, I mean, as I was playing it, I was like, oh, the days seem to be getting shorter. And then you realise that that's part of the story. But the way that that game... there is also a sort of, like, horror survival level, which freaked me out very, very much in that game. But, yeah, Final Fantasy XV, I know it didn't live up to a lot of people's expectations, but actually, the sort of character archetypes that are used, the way the narrative unfolds, the way that the player has some control but not complete control, the just the central ideas of light and dark and legacy and heritage, I think is a very classic Gothic story. But again, going back to what we were talking about global Gothic, I mean, I often talk about Final Fantasy X in this respect as Gothic, but I think Final Fantasy XV really, for me, epitomised that meeting of Western and Southeast Asian Gothic in a video game format. So, yeah, Final Fantasy XV, I mean, I actually really did enjoy it, and I've been replaying it recently for a piece that I'm hoping to write on it, but, yeah, unexpectedly, I found, and I know we joke, I see Gothic everywhere, but that game for me... had a lot of really fantastic Gothic elements. And then I know we've talked about Dragon Age, but actually Dragon Age 2, in terms of a multi-textual text, because the whole game is framed as Varric telling Cassandra a story, and you don't actually know as player whether or not the story that he's telling you is the real story. So just from the fact that I think it's really fascinating that you have this game where you're playing and you're making decisions, but ultimately, what you're actually doing is playing Varric's version of events, potentially. So yeah, I mean, all the Dragon Age games have a lot of Gothic element to them, but I think 2 had a lot of problems. But yeah, you could. I'm desperate to do something Gothic on Dragon Age 2.
So Lauren had no problem at all just rattling.
I've been thinking about this all day. I've been thinking, Emily said this morning, we might need to give our like top 3 picks, and I was like, oh god, what will I say?
Well predicted. That was I thought those were just off the cuff.
No,
like, wow.
I've been thinking about that all day.
You're prepped. Emily, what about you?
For me, I'm going to be a really basic. I'll say Witcher 3 to start with, mainly because I'm still in the world of thinking that Witcher 3 is the greatest RPG ever made. And this is someone who played it for an exceptionally long period of time and then got the worst ending. And I still stand by that game, but. I just think, like, I did a paper, I think last year, about Witcher 3, and I wrote an article in PC Gamer about it as well, because I literally just want to find a young PGR, a young postgraduate, and just grab them by the shoulders and say, okay, if you want to do a PhD on Gothic games, you need to study Witcher 3, because it is just, it's got everything. It has literally every archetype. It just goes hard and fast for the Gothic. It's got haunted houses, it's got damsels, it's got, you know, people being changed into different sized animals. It's got werewolves, it's got vampires, it's got everything. So I'll start with that. For my second choice, I'll probably go for something along the lines of the now incredibly problematic Gabriel Knight series. Mm-hmm. It's a good example of what the Southern Gothic used to be known as. If you were looking for what a surface level representation of Southern Gothic, you can't really go any better than the Gabriel Knight series, because...
No.
It's about, obviously, for people who don't know, it's about a detective who, I think he's in New Orleans, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and he basically has a lot of either occult or religious tasks that he has to do and solve these problems. It's very, very Gothic. It's trying to be, and it succeeds. But it is, I will say that it is slightly problematic.
Yeah.
Just a bit.
Yeah. A tiny, tiny bit racist.
Just a tiny bit. and I implore you to look instead at its wonderful 8-bit graphics. Lastly, I'll probably say that I have a real soft spot for walking simulators. I also have a really soft spot for calling them walking simulators, even though people think that calling something a walking simulator
derogatory.
It's an insult, and why would you want to play a game where you just walk around? But I think walking simulators in general have this very close connection to the Gothic. They've got a very close connection to the sublime. They're trying really hard to make you be immersed in this other world, and nearly all of them, because of their nature of being slightly puzzle-based, nearly all of them are like mysteries. So games like Firewatch or Everybody's Gone to the Rapture or Dear Esther all have elements of, you know, mystery and wonder and the sublime. Plus, they're all just really beautiful games, and I really try my best to encourage people to realize that playing games is not just playing Call of Duty, it's not just playing Candy Crush, and it's not just playing Pokemon Go. There are games out there for everyone, for any type of player, and I just feel like walking simulators especially are one of those games that I often show them to people who don't play games, and it's like this whole other world is expanded for people. And I think they really have that element of the kind of armchair story of, you know, you two can solve this mystery. And that's a very Gothic tradition too. So I'll
so is that
them.
your third game is walking
simulators? It's walking simulators. So maybe Firewatch or Everybody's Gone to the Rapture. I feel bad saying Firewatch because it is just a mystery, but I just really loved that game.
It's very sublime.
Yeah, same.
Yeah.
Cool. So there you have it. That's so many. This show's going out on Halloween, so there are so many Halloween recommendations there. So I think we're going to wrap it there. It's been amazing. So thank you, Emily and Lauren. Thanks so much for coming on. I was so excited about this.
Thank you so much for having us and for listening to us.
Been fantastic. I want you to come back every Halloween.
Yes, we can make this
Don't
thing.
Say that. You won't be able to get rid of it.
Yeah, next time we can talk about Gotham.
Yes, exactly. I'm afraid, Drew, we have to do an episode on Gotham. You're going to have to watch it. Because Emily and I are obsessed. That's how we bonded on Twitter was through Gotham GIFs.
Yeah, just like 10-page succession.
Yeah. I got no work done that day because I was hunting for a new Gotham GIF to send Emily. Oh dear. So that's our inner lives.
Did you guys want to
Drew,
talk about your things? And anything you want to plug?
So where can people find out more about Gaming the Gothic? Is there going to be another one? And your social media places, if you want people to follow you, and any cool things that you're doing?
We're on Twitter at Sheffield Gothic. We have a conference which is running, by the time this goes out, it will have already happened, called Reimagine the Gothic, but we do that every year, and it's a conference devoted to rethinking, reexamining, and reimagining the Gothic. And it's all about taking the Gothic outside of academia's ivory tower and trying to diversify it and trying to encourage new areas of study. And Gaming the Gothic very much came out of that. We had a very successful Gaming the Gothic panel at last year's Reimagining. So watch this space. Hopefully there will be another Gaming the Gothic, but there will always be gaming things going on at Sheffield Gothic, definitely.
And your Twitter is?
I'm at Literary Law. Which I picked in 2010, and it seemed like a good idea. But if you look, for Lauren Nixon, you'll find me.
So you can also find Gaming the Gothic at Gaming the Gothic on Twitter, which we do pay attention to, even though we don't currently have a date for the next one. You can follow me on Emily R. Marlowe at Twitter, or you can go to my website, which is emilymarlowe.co.uk. You can also find a couple of articles I've written for PC Gamer on their website, which is pcgamer.com.
And yeah, I'm just on Twitter all the time with Gotham GIFs. So hit me up on Instagram. that'll
do K-pop it.
GIFs. It's one or the other.
It'll just make your day better. Trust me.
Yeah. That's what I'm here for.
Cool. Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, so that was Argue the Toss. You can talk to us about all things Gothic, all things games, films, you know the drill. We're at gameindustry.com, on Twitter at Argue the Cast. We're on Spotify, SoundCloud, Libs. Where else are we?
All sorts of places.
iTunes, all the podcast places. So come and say hi and give us a thumbs up and all that good stuff. And happy Halloween.
Yeah, that is.
Until next time, Drew.
Cheerio.